Valentine, Bushby, Palmer, and Wood. The Times carried this story on page 73. In terms of political realities in New York State, it was the story, above all the merger stories, that should have been on page 1. All bases were covered. When the Times editorialized that it was sure the merger would be legal, Franklin S. Wood wrote the editors a letter, concluding dryly, "Your opinion will not, we think, be shared by most lawyers." But Moe's precautions were superfluous, a case of overkill. The Lindsay merger proposal had been dead long before, as soon as it was made, in fact. The actual murder had been delayed until the public hearing, only to add to his humiliation. "By the way," Travia told reporters during a mid-afternoon recess, "the legislation should never have been sent up to Albany in the first place without a home rule message from the city council. He didn't see how that had happened. The legislature could not consider it without such a message." That was rubbing it in, some listening legislators said, unable quite to hide their smiles. Travia had, of course, known all along that a home rule message was required. Everyone had known. He could have mentioned the fact to Rosen previously. He must have forgotten to do so. The bill was dead, although Lindsay did not have the sense to let it die quietly. He telephoned Rockefeller for support, instructed Rosen to get to work on the legislators. But the support from the governor was somehow never forthcoming. The mayor announced to reporters that it had never occurred to anyone that it would be necessary to have a home rule resolution, but that now the legislature was trying to buck pass the matter back to the city council. When he asked the council for the home rule message, the request never even got out of committee. The parade of the power brokers had, to anyone interested in the nuances of true power in New York State, been a good show. It was to be the last Robert Moses ever produced. The Imperial Guard would never charge for him again. On July 11, 1966, he had arranged a celebration to mark the 30th anniversary of the opening of the Triborough Bridge. There were crowds. 3,500 children rounded up from housing projects and by the Police Athletic League and bused to Randall's Island for the occasion, and pageantry. Officials used silver shears to snip a ribbon at the Queen's end of the span and then rode in a 12-car motorcade, 11 limousines led by Moses in a 1936 Ford touring car driven by Omero C. Catan of Teaneck, New Jersey, who on July 11, 1936, when the Great Bridge first opened, had been the first driver to cross, to Randall's Island, where bands played and speeches were given, and a sumptuous luncheon in Triborough's state dining room. 3,500 box lunches were there for the children, and brochures, a magnificently printed, boxed volume recording the authorities' achievements, entitled 30 Years of Accomplishment. In his speech, Moses effectively disposed of the Triborough surpluses Lindsay was always talking about, announcing that he had committed $40 million in authority funds for improvements to authority-owned bridges, no city approval needed, such as a new toll plaza for the Triborough and a complete reconstruction of the Cross Bay, and $8 million to the Park Department for new playgrounds. With Austin Tobin of the Port Authority taking the opportunity to tell reporters present that he was planning to open bids for the World Trade Center shortly, despite the fact that Lindsay had not yet approved the project, the ceremony was turned into a demonstration by the city's two great rump governments that they were planning to proceed in future as they had in past, without being bound by the wishes of City Hall. To keep the bridge clear for the motorcade, all other traffic had been barred from the Queen's span, and as the officials cut ribbons, thousands of Manhattan-bound motorists were kept waiting for half an hour behind them in broiling heat, while Triborough Bridge and Tunnel officers ignored the angry protest, not allowing them on the bridge until the motorcade had completed a markedly leisurely trip to Randall's Island. And there was praise enough even for Moses, Austin Tobin lauding his great gifts of intellect, imagination, courage, and dynamic energy, as well as his instinct for the jugular. Queensborough President Mario Cariello telling the children that New York City would never be what it is today had Moses been born in South America, Australia, or at the North Pole. But the celebration ended on a distinctly sour note. While Moses was still bidding his guests farewell, a messenger from the mayor's office handed an aide a letter for Moses, and the aide gave it to Moses, and Moses, ripping it open, saw that it was a letter dismissing him as Arterial Highway's representative. The mayor had taken this step, which he should have taken before the merger fight, after it was over, too late to help him in it, but he had taken it. Once, Robert Moses had held 12 government jobs simultaneously. Now he was reduced to one, the chairmanship of the Triborough Authority. And within the week, Lindsay had moved to give himself a toehold even in Moses' last stronghold. Commissioner Tracy's term had expired on June 30th. The mayor appointed Transportation Administrator Palmer in his place. The Palmer appointment had no effect on Moses' power. The primary purpose of putting him on the board, Lindsay had told him, was to protect the city's interest by saving as much of the surplus as possible. But Palmer proved unable to accomplish anything. "The first time I voted no on a proposal, Moses got up and walked around and gave me a half-hour speech, how I didn't understand how these things were done. It was probably the first no vote in the history of Triborough, and the staff was also appalled. They had never seen Moses confronted before." But the vote on the issue was 2-1, with the other commissioner, realtor and Democratic financier Norman K. Winston, voting with Moses. Palmer says he had been told that Winston might be ready to be wooed away from Moses, but their first talk indicated that that was wrong. Winston was ready to follow the chairman unquestioningly on every decision. And that, of course, made Palmer's opposition academic. He consistently voted against Moses' proposals and always lost 2-1. He was not even able to stop Moses' commitment of an additional $20 million of surplus to the building of a second deck on the Verrazano Bridge, a project to which Lindsay was adamantly opposed. As for Lindsay's other move, the ending of Moses' designation as Arterial Highways representative, that would have slashed Moses' power greatly if it had stuck, but whether it would have or not is by no means certain. By the end of the year, Lindsay was beginning to display signs of an awareness of the need for accommodation with the labor power brokers he had scorned, and they were determined to keep at least some of Moses' highways alive and well and driving toward inauguration. And the best way to do that, they were convinced, was to keep Moses in charge of them. Moreover, if the mayor wanted to build any highways at all, he had little choice. Only Moses had the plans for major expressways, and only Moses had the money for further plans. An astonished and dismayed Lindsay was informed that to plan a completely different arterial program would take 5 years and would cost, in either fees to consultant engineering firms or salaries for a sufficient number of civil service engineers, $7 million a year, an amount there was absolutely no chance of the financially strapped city ever raising. Moses, moreover, had far more leverage even than those contained in the rolls of blueprints piled on Triborough shelves. He had Triborough's money, for of course the authority would, in the next year or two, have millions, tens of millions of dollars of capitalizable income that had not been committed for specific projects. One estimate of the money available for this purpose over the next 3 years was $250 million. This money could be used to pay part of the costs of highway projects. In fact, many highway projects would not be feasible without sizable Triborough contributions. No man with $250 million to spend on public works in a financially strapped city desperate to build public works could possibly be frozen out of public works negotiations with federal and state governments. In reality, he would, whether designated as arterial representative or not, still be that representative in fact, if not in name, until he could be replaced as Triborough's chairman. He could not be replaced as chairman until June 30, 1970, and by that time there might well be a new mayor, one who wouldn't want to replace him. While Moses' removal was headlined by the press, which speculated week after week that he might soon be removed from power entirely by the mayor, Lindsay's latest gestures were in many ways as futile as the others the mayor had made against Moses. By this time, however, it didn't matter to Moses what Lindsay did. Someone much smarter than the mayor, the governor, who had already stripped so much of his power away from him, was moving against him now, trying to remove him, once and for all, from the last of the power he had held for 40 years. Chapter 49. The Last Stand. Rockefeller had been laying his transportation plans out for 8 years. Now they were ready. Ronan had filled in the details. Lindsay's attempt to take over the transportation setup had been the final factor in determining the governor to move to implement them. If there was going to be a takeover, it was going to be his takeover. And therefore, the governor seemed to feel, it was time for Moses to go. To implement his grand conception, the governor needed money, a particular kind of money, seed money. It was, of course, impossible, in so inflationary an era, to calculate with precision the cost of the network of highways, mass transit facilities, and airports of which he was dreaming. If he had even a rough estimate, moreover, he made sure it was never revealed honestly to the public, for a very sound political reason when dealing with a legislature in which upstate conservatives played a prominent role. It was almost unimaginably huge. One estimate, probably far too low, was that, if begun in 1968, it would cost $6.4 billion in the next 5 years alone. Much of this money Rockefeller had to obtain from the federal government, but federal contributions were determined in some cases by state and local participation in the funding. That meant local money. In almost all cases, federal contributions were dependent on state and local planning. Nelson Rockefeller had learned what Moses knew, that it was the state with plans, not vague proposals, but detailed blueprints, ready when new federal appropriations became available, that got the federal money. And certain pieces of the grand conception could not be built by the federal government at all, because the only way to make their building feasible was to make them toll or revenue-producing facilities, for which federal expenditures were prohibited. But state and local money on the scale the governor needed was simply unavailable. 8 years of his massive spending had reduced the state to a condition in which it was all but impossible for him to meet the constitutional requirement that he balance its budget annually. Costs were outrunning revenues even for current programs. State revenues could simply not support a major new one. A $500 million highway bond issue passed some years before was all but exhausted in 1966. If a new one wasn't approved, highways would have to be built out of current revenues, which meant that, in effect, no major new highways would be built. As for local money, New York City money, deficits stared him in the face everywhere. Transit Authority deficits, Long Island Railroad deficits, Penn Central Railroad deficits, the city itself so broke that it had to borrow money each year just to pay current bills. Everywhere, that is, but in the accounts of the two giant public authorities, Port and Triborough. Port, armored by the fact that he had to win approval from the New Jersey governor and legislature for anything he wanted that agency to do, was, for the immediate future at least, beyond his reach. And that left just one place to turn. The Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority had $110 million in cash and securities on hand, a surplus that was growing at the rate of almost $30 million a year, a surplus that would grow much faster if Triborough's tolls were raised, and Rockefeller was already secretly considering raising the tolls, a capitalizable surplus worth over the next 5 years, even if current tolls were not raised, perhaps $500 million. He needed that money. He wanted it. And Moses, adamant that he and he alone would decide how it was to be used, stood in his way. And more important than money was personality. There were Ronans and Moses, of course, the personality of the cool, cautious, bankerly corporation man versus that of the bold, slashing, imaginative creator. An exceptionally perceptive politician and reader of men who had plenty of time to read those two and who was to have a ringside seat during the ensuing struggle, Assembly Speaker Perry Duryea, says, "They were too antagonistic to work together in any setup. And there were Rockefellers and Moses. When Moses was in a picture, he dominated it. Any transportation improvement in which he played any sort of a key role would, in the public's eye, be his improvement, not the governor's." So, as Duryea says, Rocky wasn't satisfied with what happened in 62. He really had to knock him out of the box. And Moses had so little left to fight back with. Once he had had so much. With income from the state power, Jones Beach and Bethpage authorities, as well as from a state park commission and parks council, as well as the city park department, Triborough's annual surplus had been only one piece of a very large pie. More important than the size of the pie had been the fact that it was divided into so many pieces. More important than the amount of money at his command was the fact that this money came from so many different and varied sources that he had held simultaneously 12 different government jobs, some state and some city. A governor contemplating removing him from those under his control would have to reckon with the fact that, because Moses' authority chairmanships had staggered 6-year terms, he could do even that only over a period of years. And he had to reckon with the fact that, not only during those years but thereafter, Moses would still be holding many powerful city posts, that you'd have to fight him on so many different fronts. Moses had been able to prop up each post with others, to use each as leverage to make the others more powerful than they would otherwise have been. The position in which he had once stood had been all but unassailable. But he had, by resigning in anger from his state posts, knocked out many of the props himself. Now all the props were gone. His single remaining post stood alone. And he now had only $30 million a year left to fight with. A significant sum, but not when measured against the resources of the state that were the resources at his foe's command, and a sum even less significant because it was derived from only one post, his last post, so that men who choose up sides on the basis of money could see clearly that if he lost that post, he would have nothing left to give them, a factor which made them reluctant to take his side. If Robert Moses had still possessed 12 jobs, if Triborough had still consisted of 12 arms, Nelson Rockefeller might have found, as Harriman and Dewey and Roosevelt had found, that it was unfeasible to cut off one of them. But now Triborough consisted only of Triborough. A governor could lop off that arm with the assurance that if he did so, Moses would have none left at all. Moses' lone position might still have been secure, for it rested on the solid rock of the Triborough bond covenants, the contracts sacred under law. Not even a governor, backed by the legislature and armed with the full authority of the state, could break those covenants, for if he tried, bondholders could sue, and the courts would surely uphold them. Except for one consideration. While in theory, even a single injured bondholder could sue, in practice, no individual bondholder would. In the first place, the legal costs of so complicated a suit would, even in the preliminary steps, be enormous, far beyond any injury the bondholder might have suffered or any damages he could realistically claim. More important, a bondholder contemplating an individual suit would be faced with a legal reality. Suing as an individual would be viewed by a court as an admission that only he was hurt. Why weren't other bondholders suing? So that the bondholders, or a substantial number of them, would have to sue as a group. To cover such a possibility, an agent had been appointed, in the contracts, to protect the bondholders' rights, to, if necessary, sue on their behalf. The contracts had appointed a bondholder's trustee. And the trustee was the Chase Manhattan Bank. And the Chase Manhattan Bank was the only large bank in the United States still controlled by a single family. The governors. After the 1966 legislature had wound up its business without passing our bill and had gone home, we began to get straws in the wind that the governor and Ronan had plans of their own for taking over transportation. Arthur Palmer says, Lindsay was in no position to object, desperate as he was for a way out of the continual financial crisis posed by the subways, and for a way to avoid a second fare increase. Lindsay had already raised it from 15 to 20 cents before he had to run for re-election in 1969. Moreover, neither the mayor nor his aides seemed to have grasped the extent of the power Ronan was negotiating away from the city. By January 4, 1967, Rockefeller was confident enough of city cooperation to ask legislature and voters to approve a $2 billion bond issue for highways, mass transit facilities, and airports throughout the state, and to begin planning a coordinated, balanced, regional approach, with far greater emphasis than ever before on mass transit to transportation in the metropolitan region, merging and incorporating in Ronan's Metropolitan Commuter Transportation Authority all the region's public transportation agencies, the New York City Transit Authority, the Manhattan and Bronx Surface Transit Operating Authority, MABSTOA, the Long Island, Penn Central, and New Haven Railroads, the Staten Island Rapid Transit Service, and the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. Rockefeller had a lot riding on approval, not only the plan itself, which had fully captured his imagination, but a consideration considerably more mundane. Driven to the wall by the state's worsening financial crisis, the governor had, through various budgetary devices, discharged his legal obligation to balance the budget by including in anticipated revenues a substantial amount, according to some sources $49 million, according to others $51 million, according to still others $89 million, in money from the bond issue for which he was still asking approval. If it were not approved, the resultant deficit would prove highly embarrassing. The governor was, moreover, planning to use bond issue monies to help in future budgets. If it were not approved, the state would be in for a truly hair-raising tax increase, one that would reinforce his image as a wildly spending liberal among the Republican conservatives across the country whose support he needed for his planned 1968 presidential bid. The emphasis on mass transit ensured media support for the plan in the metropolitan area, and, with leading politicians, Democratic and Republican, endorsing it, legislative approval was assured. Approval in the November referendum, however, was more doubtful. Widespread voter resentment against higher taxes had in recent years caused the rejection of many bond issues. The governor was worried about the so-called silent vote. Resentment on the part of upstate conservative voters against the governor's free-spending, high-taxing policies was flooding toward a crest that would spill over in the conservative legislative revolt 2 years later. In an off-year election, with most voters apathetic and the turnout small, passage of controversial bond issues is traditionally difficult when the only voters who turn out in force are those opposed to specific transportation projects. Results of Rockefeller-commissioned polls were highly discouraging. With the issue in the balance, Rockefeller was afraid that Moses would tip it against him. The powerful construction labor unions were still solidly behind Moses, for Van Arsdale and Brennan knew that vast allocations were of little use in creating jobs unless the crushing of local opposition and the planning and blueprinting that had to take place before men could actually be put to work was ramrodded through. And their meetings with Ronan had convinced them that he was not a ramrod, if indeed he was even competent, which the two union leaders doubted. You need a man who knows how to put a show on the road, Brennan was to say. We had to keep Moses in there. More important, Moses still possessed his name, which, while a symbol around Washington Square of all that was hated, was a symbol of something quite different in Queens and Staten Island. Moses would continue to have the voters' ears, the governor knew, because he still had the News and Newsday, the papers with the largest circulation in New York City and on Long Island. In its editorial on the governor's proposal, for example, the latter had said, "Essential is the participation of Bob Moses in the new agency. His experience will be invaluable." Most important of all, Moses still possessed, unimpaired by his 78 years, the instrument that had gotten him power in the first place, his powerful, supple intelligence. Alone now, Robert Moses began doing what he had done when he had been trying to find a way out of the West Side Improvement financial impasse, when he had conceived the possibilities of the public authority, at so many crises during his career, jotting down figures on a yellow legal notepad. Ronan's public relations man had been feeding the press figures showing that the unification would end the city's traditional subway deficit crisis. Several years later, Duryea, no friend of Ronan's, could still recall them with a wry grin. The surplus from Triborough would be $30 million a year. The surplus from MABSTOA would be about $5 million. The Long Island Railroad would either break even or have a surplus of about $1 million. And these surpluses would be just enough to make up the Transit Authority deficit. But Moses found that the merger wouldn't come close to making up the transit deficit. Calculating the present and future cost of union contracts then being negotiated, and union contracts that would have to be negotiated within the next year or two, increasing maintenance costs and future debt service, he concluded that MABSTOA and LIRR would not have small surpluses, but tremendous deficits, and that the Transit Authority's deficit was growing so fast that no conceivable combination of contributions from other agencies could make it up. The primary rationale that the governor was using to sell the plan to the conservative upstate voters, that it would free the state once and for all from the annual worries about New York's subway problem, wasn't true at all. And that was only one small point proved by Moses' figures. Since he had become governor, Rockefeller had created several giant public authorities that were bastards of the genre because their revenue bonds would be paid off not out of their own revenues, but out of the general revenues of the state. No one outside the governor's confidential staff had ever figured out what the total debt service on all these bond issues was going to be when they were all sold and paying interest simultaneously. Only one other state official, the quietly independent Democratic comptroller, Arthur Levitt, was interested in doing so. Teams of his auditors had just begun calculating that very point. Moses did it alone. He would never discuss what he found. But Duryea, his last friend in power, and the one he took most fully into his confidence at this stage in his career, did, in an interview in 1969. 3 years ago, the state had budgeted for debt service $25 to $30 million. Last year, it was $40 million, and this year, $47 million. Well, Moses had a projection that if all the authorities Rocky was proposing went through, the debt service in 1972, this was the year of total sale, would be $500 million. Rockefeller's proposals would load down present and future taxpayers of the state with a staggering debt. In addition, Moses had done the simple multiplication necessary to figure out something all the reporters and editorial writers who had written about the $2.5 billion Metropolitan Transportation Authority bond issue had apparently never bothered to figure out, at least not one of them had mentioned the point, how much that bond issue was going to cost the taxpayers in interest. The answer was more than $1 billion. $1 billion in interest. By the time Moses finished figuring, Duryea says, he had some numbers that were devastating. The implications were enormous. If he had ever gone screaming to the public, Duryea says. Moses not only possessed devastating numbers, he could devastate with them. While other opponents of the bond issue had no money to put their case before the public, Moses, with the resources of Triborough still behind him, did, and his prestige alone guaranteed him a full hearing in the media. Let him take those numbers to the public with his vast and efficient public relations apparatus, and he could well wreck Rockefeller's grand conception. And he was prepared to do so. Only two or three of us knew of these figures, Duryea says, but we knew that Moses was ready to blow the governor's transportation referendum with them. They had to get him on board so that he wouldn't scream and holler. Before delivering his State of the State message, the governor and Ronan had had at least one conference with Moses at which they attempted to enlist his support. They failed. He flew off to a vacation in the Bahamas, still an opponent. While he was there, Ronan drafted and airmailed to the old warrior, honing his rapier down there in the warm sun, some modifications designed to mollify. They did not. During the 3 weeks he stayed away following the governor's speech, reporters checked with Triborough daily to try to talk to him, and as soon as he returned, he had a statement for them. He was too smart to play his trump on the first hand. It was not empty victory, but power in the new transportation setup that he wanted. He did not reveal his figures, but he gave the governor an inkling of the intensity of the opposition he was prepared to provide. It was uncompromising. The merger proposal was absurd, he said. Grotesque. It just won't work. They don't know what they are driving at. And the opposition made major stories in every metropolitan area newspaper. On March 9, 1967, Moses met with Rockefeller in Rockefeller's 55th Street townhouse. And 2 days later, he announced that the governor's plan, the absurd, grotesque plan, was indispensable, and that he was supporting it. We believe the governor is on the right track, but only a bold approach can succeed, and for our part shall cooperate to this end. Said Ronan, this is welcome news. The reason Moses gave for his 180-degree change of heart was that, after considerable discussion, the governor included in his proposal a paragraph on protecting the rights of Triborough bondholders. Actually, however, nothing new of any major significance to the bondholders had been added to the proposal. Levitt and Duryea knew the real reason. The governor had bought Moses' support with the only coin in which Moses was interested, power, a promise that he would have it under the revised transportation setup. I know for a fact that Rockefeller felt he had bought Moses' support, Duryea says. How do I know? I know because one Monday in Albany, it was at one of those Monday morning so-called leadership conferences, Rockefeller announced that Moses would support his transportation unification program. I said, what did you give him? And Rockefeller said, a promise that he wouldn't be thrown in the ash can, that he would be given something substantial in the MTA reorganization. Levitt had even more conclusive proof. To gain maximum impact for his figures, Moses knew they should be released by someone other than himself, someone who could not be accused of having a personal stake in the defeat of the transportation proposal. On March 8th, the day before his conference with the governor, he had telephoned Levitt, who recalls, he called me up and said, I want to see you. I have figures, and I want you to use them and blast Rockefeller. The very next day, I had to go to 55th Street for a meeting of the state pension fund. I didn't know what room to go in, and I was wandering around from room to room, trying doors, and I opened one, and there, to my surprise, was Moses and his whole coterie. I said, what are you doing here? He said, oh, waiting to see the governor. I said, where are those figures? He said, oh, I'll send them to you, in a hedging tone of voice. And the next day he comes out for MTA. I never got the figures. Van Arsdale and Brennan knew the reason, too. Rockefeller had also told it to them. The day after Moses' announcement of support, Brennan, previously conspicuously silent on the governor's proposal, chimed in with his. The Times story announcing the arrival on board of the powerful Unionist contained a sentence whose source was apparently Brennan himself. It was learned that Governor Rockefeller had offered Robert Moses a seat on the MTA board, as well as continued direction of Triborough. Brennan himself confirms that Rockefeller had given Van and I that impression. The governor said he would have an important part for Moses. Not satisfied with that vague statement, the two Unionists asked Rockefeller precisely what that meant. He told them that he had given Moses what Moses wanted. "He told us Moses wanted a part of the construction." "Will he have a part?" Brennan asked. And the governor said, "Oh, absolutely. We know his talents, his ability, and we want to use them." Rockefeller was careful to leave the same impression with the public. The governor told reporters that each of the authorities, while being merged, would retain its identity and be under the administrative direction of an executive head in charge of operations, who, the Times reported, would possibly have the title of president of the agency. President of Triborough. That sounded even better than chairman. Moses appears to have had no doubt that the governor would keep his promise. His statement announcing his support of the referendum had stated, "If the verdict is favorable, all the talent and goodwill available must be recruited to realize the exceedingly complex long-term improvements." He had no doubt that that talent would, in the fields of highways and bridges, continue to be his own. And with that assurance in hand, he proceeded during the 7 months prior to the referendum to prove that he would violate any principle, even that most sacred one to which he had always sworn allegiance, the sacredness of the bondholders' covenants, to keep power. He outdid himself in support of the referendum. When Rockefeller didn't contact him, he called the governor's office to ask for an appointment so that he could learn how he could best be of assistance in persuading voters, and following that meeting, he lied for the referendum. Although he knew that bond revenues were slated for approach roads to his proposed Long Island Sound crossing, he told the press, "Statements that the pending transportation proposition is to be tapped to pay in whole or in part for the Long Island Sound crossing are wholly irresponsible and malicious. Not a cent of state subvention, aid, or credit is required. Poured money behind it, using Triborough funds to pay for a full-scale advertising campaign. Traffic, commuter, transit delays, got your goat? Don't sit and grumble, get out and vote. Plastering Triborough's toll booths with huge vote yes signs," and repeatedly flattered the governor so enthusiastically and obsequiously, Governor Rockefeller has guts. It takes a lot of courage and faith to ask the voters to approve a $2.5 billion. That at times he seemed to be almost desperately trying to reassure Rockefeller that the governor wouldn't have to worry about his loyalty after the reorganization, that he could be a loyal member of his team. After an almost equally frantic statewide campaign by Rockefeller, the referendum passed. But there remained another, equally important reason to keep Moses on board. There was still the possibility of a legal fight over whether the Triborough bond covenants would be violated by the merger of the authority into a larger authority, a question which, it seemed likely, could, if pressed, be resolved only one way, in the bondholders' favor. Any party to a contract can bring suit if he feels it has been violated. There were two parties to the contracts that were the Triborough bonds, the authority and the bondholders, represented by the trustee Chase Manhattan Bank. Prior to his March meeting with Rockefeller, Moses had prepared to have the authority bring suit. He had instructed Sam Rosenman to gear up for a full-scale, no-holds-barred legal battle. But after his March 9th meeting with Rockefeller, he had Rosenman stand down, at least in part. The attorney, on behalf of Triborough, joined Dewey, representing Chase Manhattan, in attacking the proposal to use the authority's surpluses, but let the former governor carry the load, following through only pro forma, and he dropped opposition to the merger, the part that would have deprived Moses of power. Because, of course, Moses believed Rockefeller had promised him power after the merger as well. I understand that he had a promise that he would be part of the MTA board, Dewey was to recall. I don't think Rosenman would have been so cooperative with the MTA if Moses hadn't thought that he'd have a place. Of the circumstances surrounding the final removal of Robert Moses from power, the key one, the resolution of the suit against the merger that, if successful, could have kept him in power, remains shrouded in mystery. Two things are clear. One, that, in the opinion of almost every legal expert on municipal and public authority bonds, if the suit had been prosecuted vigorously, it would have been successful. The merger would have been voided. Until all its $367,200,000 bonds had been redeemed, the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority would have remained an independent, autonomous agency, and if the authority chose not to redeem its bonds, it would have remained independent and autonomous indefinitely. Two, that the suit was not prosecuted vigorously. Why the suit was not prosecuted vigorously is not known. Chase Manhattan had certainly given the impression that it intended to press the suit to the limit when it was filed in June 1967. The retaining of Dewey as counsel seemed proof enough of that, and the bank's initial 16-page, 36-count complaint instituting the action seemed determined. Transfer of the authority's surpluses or income to the Metropolitan Transportation Authority would, the bank's complaint stated, cause the bondholders the bank represented irreparable injury for which they have no remedy at law. Both state statute, the New York Public Authorities Law, and the authority's contract with its bondholders forbade such a financial merger until all bonds were paid off and the contract thus voided, the complaint stated. An administrative merger was similarly illegal, the brief stated, forbidden by federal and state constitutions and state law, as well as bond covenants, and was injurious to bondholders because the aims and interests of the TBTA and those of the MTA contained a basic, irreconcilable conflict. Triborough must facilitate the use of its projects by motor vehicles, whereas the MTA and the TA must facilitate the use of their respective train and subway service systems, thereby diverting traffic from Triborough Bridge and Tunnel projects. Following passage of the referendum, the suit was resumed, but all through December and January, intensive negotiations were being carried out between representatives of Governor Nelson Rockefeller and those of his brother David, Chase Manhattan's president and absolute boss. And the suit was finally settled not in court, open or closed, but in the governor's 55th Street townhouse shortly after 9 a.m., February 9, 1968, at a 50-minute meeting attended by the two brothers, each attended by one aide, Dewey for David and Ronan for Nelson. At this meeting, a 3-page stipulation previously drawn up by attorneys for both sides was signed by Nelson Rockefeller on behalf of the state of New York and David Rockefeller on behalf of the Chase Manhattan Bank. Following the meeting, the stipulation was taken to the chambers of the judge who would have been sitting on the case had there been a case, State Supreme Court Justice William C. Hecht, Jr., and sealed, not to be seen by any outsider or newspaper man. Under the stipulation, the governor's family's bank dropped all opposition to the governor's transportation merger, the merger under which the Triborough Board, Robert Moses chairman, was supplanted by the MTA Board, Dr. William J. Ronan, chairman. The point that Moses had always believed would keep him in power, therefore, was not contested, even by Moses. On his instructions, Rosenman agreed on behalf of Triborough that the merger was constitutional and legal. The crucial point was not contested by anyone. What Chase got in return is not known, although it continued to head syndicates, as it had in the past, that underwrote and purchased tens of millions of dollars in state bonds, immensely profitable to banks. Even such a bonus would probably not have persuaded the normal bank, run by a board of directors responsible to a multitude of stockholders, to abrogate its legal obligations, thereby leaving itself open to stockholder action. A bank controlled by a single family could do so, however. In the entire United States, only one bank large enough to be a trustee for $367,200,000 in bonds is still family controlled. What was necessary to remove Moses from power was a unique, singular concatenation of circumstances. That the governor of New York be the one man uniquely beyond the reach of normal political influences, and that the trustee for Triborough's bonds be a bank run by the governor's brother. Why did Moses choose to rest his future on Rockefeller's word? At least part of the answer is probably understood by the perceptive Duryea, who says he had little choice but to do so. He didn't have much left to fight with anymore, the speaker says, and probably another part is provided by Shapiro, who, asked why his boss had not exacted a promise in writing, says, I suppose because he couldn't really believe that they wouldn't want him in the picture at all. I mean, they wanted the bridge, Sound Crossing, built, didn't they? They wanted the program pushed, didn't they? And he was the only one who could push it like it should be pushed. He just couldn't understand that they might not feel like that, I suppose. I mean, it had always been like that before. Rockefeller's promise to Moses had served its purpose well. It had kept Moses quiet for almost a year, persuaded him not to oppose Rockefeller's transportation merger or the referendum which had funded it. The governor's promise had, moreover, persuaded Moses to withdraw the lawsuit which might have invalidated Rockefeller's transportation merger. It had enabled Rockefeller to use his name. And now, having used his name, having gotten everything out of him that he could, the governor threw him away. Up until the very day on which the crucial stipulation was signed and sealed, all was honey between the governor and the old man, now 79. On February 9th, the day it was signed, Moses still believed he had a firm promise that he would have a substantial role in the new setup, possibly as president or executive head of Triborough, certainly as a member of the MTA board. Then, with less than 3 weeks before the merger was to take effect, the mask dropped away. Immediately following the stipulation signing, Moses telephoned the governor for an appointment. He got one, and when they met, Rockefeller apparently repeated his promise. Moses said that the governor told me I would be appointed to the MTA and would have the title of president or something of the sort at the head of Triborough under the general supervision of the MTA. But, Moses says, Dr. Ronan did not like this. Perry Duryea says that Moses asked me really to intercede with the governor and Ronan to attempt to guarantee that he would get a meaningful position. He didn't ask me himself. He had someone else. Shapiro says it was he. Asked me if we could get together, and I went to his apartment in New York. He had met with Ronan and Rockefeller the week before, and he left that meeting with a very bad taste in his mouth. He felt the governor hadn't given him the time he deserved. The governor was in and out of the room. The conference was interrupted. It was left that Ronan would call him in a week, and he hadn't heard from Ronan. And the deadline, the date for the merger, was midnight, February 29th. At 12:01 a.m., March 1st, the Triborough Board would go out of existence. He would be out of a job, out of power completely. Duryea felt sorry for Moses. It was his dream to be part of the new transportation setup, the speaker says. He still felt the drive and the involvement, the old fire horse when the bell clangs. Here was this great new thing going forward. He wanted to be part of it. Duryea agreed to intercede on the old man's behalf, and thereafter, no more than a day or two at most before the merger took effect, Ronan contacted Moses. He offered Moses a post as consultant to the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. The post, he said, carried with it a salary of $25,000 a year and continued use of his limousine, his chauffeurs, and his secretaries. Moses would be in charge of coordinating Triborough's present construction program, and his primary responsibility would be the Long Island Sound crossing. Whether Moses could bring himself to question Ronan further about the details of this offer himself, or whether he had an intermediary do it, is not known. But with each answer he received, his humiliation must have deepened. For there were no further details. That offer was all there was. He had thought he had been promised a seat on the MTA board. There was no mention of such a seat now. During the next day or two, in fact, Ronan announced the names of the 9 members of the board of the agency that would be responsible for all intrastate public transportation in the New York metropolitan region. The name of Robert Moses was not among them. Moses had thought he had had a promise of Triborough's presidency, or at least its chief executive officer, whatever the precise title might be. Ronan did not make any mention of such a promise now. In fact, when Moses or his intermediary asked Ronan directly about it, Ronan replied that there would be a chief executive officer, but it would be Joseph F. Vermaelen, Moses' chief engineer. Vermaelen and Liebwahl and the rest of Moses' team would report directly to the MTA staff. Analyzing the offer only deepened the humiliation. Coordinating Triborough's current construction program was a meaningless phrase. That program consisted only of a relatively minor reconstruction of the Cross Bay Bridge and the adding of a second deck on the Verrazano, and those projects were already underway. The Sound Crossing would be a great project, but no one knew when it would start, and it would probably not start soon. And that was only one project, one for a man accustomed to directing dozens. "Don't take all Bob's toys away," Moses' wife had begged the governor. Well, the governor hadn't. He had left him one, or to be more precise, the promise of one. When the implications of what Ronan was saying sank in, Moses realized that he was being allowed, almost as a gesture of charity, to keep the perquisites of office, the car, the chauffeurs, the secretaries, but not so much as a shred of power. He could, if he wished, stay on at the authority he had created and made strong and great, but not only would he no longer be in charge of it, he would no longer have any say in its affairs. Even the men around him, his muchachos, the men who had looked to him for leadership for so many years, would now be reporting to someone else. The offer was a slap in the face, but there was no other offer. The fatal deadline of March 1st was upon him. He had no choice but to accept it. On the very last day before the merger was to take effect, he did so. His statement to the press, issued the following day, the day the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, the last remaining arm of once 12-armed Triborough, became a unit of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, was one sentence long. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority has offered me an advisory post in the Metropolitan Transportation Enterprise, and I have accepted. More poignant than his statement on the day of the merger was his attitude. Ronan had scheduled for that day a ceremonial tour of some of the Transit Authority and Triborough facilities by the members of the MTA board. Believing he would be one of them, Moses had invited Ronan and the board to lunch with him at Randall's Island, and Ronan had accepted. Now, though he sat at the head of the big table in the big dining room, as he had sat there at 1,000 lunches during the 34 years he had been head of Triborough, he had to know that he was sitting there only by sufferance, that he, who so loved to be the gracious host, was in reality not the host of that luncheon at all, that he was only a guest himself. The very cost of the lunch would have to be approved by someone else, by this college professor, whom he had once derided as sophomoric, but who had, he felt, weaseled his way into power, not by accomplishment, not by achievement, not by the honorable means by which he felt he had attained power, but by, he felt, ass-kissing his way around Nelson Rockefeller. Worse, much worse for him who had always delighted, gloried in giving free rein to his feelings, he could not let his feelings show. If he were ever to have any power at all again, if he were ever to actually get to build even the Sound crossing they had held out to him as a pittance, he would have to get on the good side of this man who had stripped him of power. Ronan, he felt, at least his aides say so, had defeated him not in a fair fight, but by lying to him and betraying him. But he would have to make friends with Ronan. Reporter Richard Witkin, who covered the changeover for the Times, noted that Mr. Moses seemed to go out of his way yesterday to take a back seat to Dr. Ronan. The Newsday story, which noted that Moses, who once held 14 sick public positions simultaneously, appeared to defer yesterday to Dr. William J. Ronan, noted also that the authority adopted a new emblem, a two-tone blue M, that would appear shortly on all its trains and other facilities, and said, during the last four decades, the same capital letter might have been used as a symbol of domination of the area's planning scene. But it couldn't any longer. The age of Moses was over. Begun on April 23, 1924, it had ended on March 1, 1968. After 44 years of power, the power was gone at last. Chapter 50. Old. It wasn't the spring and summer just ahead that worried the men who loved Robert Moses, but the months beyond. He had just as much energy as ever, Harold Blake said. And what was he going to do with it now? Said Arnold Vollmer, the idea of this great mind having nothing to do now, that's the most awful thing. Said Vollmer's wife, who had also worked for Robert Moses, it's horrible. For him, that would be hell. Spring and summer would cloak horror in sun and breezes, and the chance to do in full measure the things he had always been pressed for time in doing. Not only to swim, yes, he still hurled himself headfirst into big Atlantic breakers at 79, still swam out far to sea, still stayed in so long that his men, determined that there should always be someone in the water with him, were forced to perform this safety precaution in relays, young steers unable to keep up with the old bull, but to fish and sail his beloved Great South Bay, and to tramp for hours along its beaches and wetlands, to steer the sea elf himself instead of hunching over papers in the stern while Captain Pearsall steered, to cruise the bay in the late afternoon watching the gulls soar up from the marshes as the 4 o'clock breeze stirred the reeds, to be the South Shore boy he liked to call himself. But the fall and winter beyond, the months when the bay froze, the months when there was nothing Robert Moses wanted to do except work, the months when that great mind would be churning restlessly, searching insatiably for material on which to feed, those months loomed bleak and terrible. What, Blake and Vollmer and Sid Shapiro asked each other, was R.M. going to do then? If they could just get the boss through the winter, they told each other, perhaps by that time the governor would give the go-ahead for the Sound crossing. Ronan might become panicked by demonstrations of his incompetence as administrator and builder, demonstrations which, in their view and that of labor leaders, engineers, and contractors who had to deal with him, had already begun to pile up, into realizing that he needed Moses if he was to get the governor's construction programs rolling. It was not, however, necessary to wait until cold weather for the effect of powerlessness upon Robert Moses to become apparent. That year, winter came in spring. Near the end of April, less than 2 months after the chairman had become consultant, he was visited by the author at the summer cottage he was renting at Oak Beach. Because he did not then know the details of Triborough's absorption into MTA, and because there had been no official announcement that Moses had been utterly removed from power, The visitor did not know there had been so dramatic a change in the status of his host, but he saw at once that there had been a dramatic change in the host. He wrote on his notepad, "The eyes are definitely more roomy today. He seems somehow just more shrunken, too." During the interview, Moses had sent his chauffeur on